Blog Talk Radio.
Life is a song worth singing.
Life and tune.
Sing it. Life is a song worth singing. In the palm of your hand,
use it.
Don't blame your life on a master plan. Change it. Only you generate the power to decide what to do with your life. You're a fool if you think you're helpless. You control what you do with your life.
Welcome, 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 ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting edition of Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. And I'm your host, Ronald Bethay, and you know if you join us on a regular basis, you know the slogan for this show: if there's power in numbers, then the positive change purchasing cooperative captures that power for your financial benefit. The Positive Change Purchasing Cooperative, LLC, serves as an economic blueprint for self-reliance for solar and renewable energy companies, both large and small, along with increasing market share for African-American solar installation companies to address the effects of high energy costs at our historically Black colleges and universities, to utilize Black-owned farmlands and HBCU campuses, to develop capacity and initiatives for solar installation projects, to bring down the under and unemployment of young Black men and women locally and nationally, also to educate the Black community locally and nationally about the economic impacts of climate change and the need for environmental education in the Black community through Black Talk Radio programs such as Solar Now and the Future with its economic impact on Black America. You know the show is also brought to you every week by the Black Sports Legends Foundation, BSLF HBCU Solar Radio Talk Show Initiative, and you're listening to that initiative over the World Wide Web, over the platform of Blog Talk Radio. We're streaming via Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn, and you can get more information about that initiative by logging on to our website at Positive Change, P as in Paul, C as in Cat, .com. That's PositiveChangePC.com. Go over to our GoFundMe link, and you'll see the information on that link. It's also brought to you every week by the National Association of Blacks in Solar, and you can get more information about that organization by logging on to blacksinsolar.org. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we have a very, very exciting show for you today because we have some guests today that are blessing the airways of this platform. We have Mr. Paul Reeves, who is the director of the PEPO Group, and his area of expertise lies in wind turbine technology and solar energy. We have the privilege of having Mr. Ellis Eugene Lawrence, professor of Department of Technology and Aviation Science, professor of Institutional Technology, Vocational Technological Education, and Industrial Engineering background. This Dr. Lawrence has a very, very extensive educational background, and he is an Aggie, so we won't hold that against him, even though we went to Morgan, and he was at North Carolina A&T, of which we have a very famous alumnus by the name of Ron McNair, and I think Ron was at North Carolina A&T around the same time that Professor Lawrence was there in the early 70s. Also, we have the privilege of having Professor Willie L. Brown, associate professor for the Department of Engineering and Aviation Sciences at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore Engineering and Aviation Science Complex. And he has a very extensive and long, what we would say, resume. So together, we have over 50 years of expertise in the engineering sciences and technology area. Now, all of you who listen to this show know I beat the drum constantly about our historically black colleges and universities and their role as we face one of the most challenging things that the U.S. economy has ever faced, which is called climate change. And I'm just going to, as we say, jump right into it. And first, gentlemen, thank you for taking time from your very, very busy schedule to join us on this platform, Solar Now in the Future with its Economic Impact on Black America. So, Paul, I want you to sort of lead off and sort of share with our listening audience who you are, what your organization does, and I titled this show The Brain Trust Behind the Renewable Energy Future at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. So the Brain Trust Behind UMES Future and Renewable Energy. So with that being said, come right on in to the conversation, Paul, and good morning.
Good morning to you. And first of all, let me just clear up something. I am not the brain trust behind UMES's stance on renewable energy. I believe that UMES is going to be in the vanguard of any type of HBCU renewable energy movement. But there were people that came before me, like Dr. Forsythe, a few other folks in agriculture, even Dr. Cairo of Agricultural Now understands the need for renewable energy. I just happened to be there at the time when they were interested in moving forward, and that just fed right into how I into my field, which is renewable energy production. I'm a developer for renewable energy and solar and wind spaces. And thank you very much for that complimentary introduction, sir.
Well, I had to come up with the title this morning, Paul, so I had to call it something, okay? So, as we said, this is Solar Now in the Future with its economic impact on Black America. So you got to insult me, but anyway, with that being said, I want to put this question out. How currently is UMES preparing its students to brave this new green world of renewable energy production? Now, either one of you gentlemen can, and I think it has a lot of spinoffs, but Dr. Brown, if you want to lead off.
Yes. So thank you for having us on, and it is a pleasure to speak about Solar Now and the Future. And just speaking of just UMES and the HBCU environment, I have had the privilege to not only serve at two institutions that is a part of the HBCU community. I have a previous colleague on the line, Dr. Ellis Lawrence, where we serve at Lizard City State University in the Department of Technology and Aviation Science. And I'm also right now currently in the capacity as an associate professor here at the Department of Engineering and Aviation Science here at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. So as we start to speak about future job impact and as we look at the HBCU environment, we know that one of the things that was the pivotal of what we started out with the history of education from an HBCU perspective, and we realized the HBCU environment or the HBCU educational system, it was built around community. So many of these colleges that we're looking into prior to the years were teacher colleges. As we start to look more into the future, we'll start to see a push not only for climate change, but innovation. So what we are trying to do is not only build our community, but bring awareness to what we have in opportunities, not only to train the next generation, but working with community partnerships. And we are definitely grateful for Paul's leadership in showing and being an advocate of HBCUs. We are definitely trying to not only see it from a community approach, but we want to break down the walls that HBCUs typically stand within the four walls and not necessarily open up the community. We want community partnership. We want to actually see individuals coming in, bringing in great ideas, small businesses especially, bringing in great ideas. Let us work with them. Let us grow as a community as we try to better our community going forward. And a lot of times you see these HBCUs are part of a farm region or a scenery of farmland. And with land grant institutions, we have that charge to not only look at available to us with farming and the opportunities of that, but how can we advance resources through technology and development. So that's my focus more so ever before. How can we communicate that to the community? How can we develop partnership? But now how can we educate our own community about what would be the future impact and how these opportunities will be beneficial to not only where we live in, but our kids and how they can go with job placements in the various fields.
Well, you said a lot and you unpacked a lot. Now, I'm going to bring Dr. Ellis right on into this conversation. Now, UMES, former Provost Dr. Thompson at that time, I think she had the vision and foresight that UMES was the first HBCU to build a 17.1-acre solar farm, and we know at that time it was the first one built on a HBCU campus. I think that's about 3.4 megawatts, Paul, on that solar farm. Paul.
It would be 2.2.
Hi, I'm still here. What did you say? 2.2 megawatts was actually.
It's 2.2. Now, looking at what took place on the Eastern Shore, as NASA curtailed its launch operations at Cape Canaveral in Florida, and they relocated those launch facilities on Aikiki Island off the Eastern Shore, there became a large proliferation and build-up of solar farms on the Eastern Shore. And it had a tremendous impact on the extracts of what we call renewable credits, green certificate market in the state of Maryland. In looking at the fact that UMES sits on 800 acres of land, if my recall serves me properly, I know that you gentlemen are working on some things. Before I get into that aspect of our conversation, I'd like for Dr. Ellis to sort of weigh in on the same question, how currently is UMES preparing students to brave this new green world renewable energy
introduction.
Hey, pardon me, Ronald.
Well,
I'd like to make a clarification. Dr. Ellis is retired from North, what is it, Elizabeth City University?
State University, yes.
Right. And so,
University.
Right, and he was, his knowledge of UMES's future plans might pale in comparison to Willie's knowledge of where they're going.
Okay, well,
I can speak for North Carolina. I've worked at a number of HBCUs. I worked at Virginia State, North Carolina A&T, and Elizabeth City State University. And I've been to a number of countries here where we were dealing with solar energy. When I was in China and Kenya and some of these other places here, they were using solar energy to heat the hot water and that sort of thing for the hot water heaters. And make a long story short, I really fail to understand why it's taken us so long to become aware of alternate energy or solar farms as a viable source. I'm going to sort of jump off the subject here a little bit, and I think it's something that blacks need to understand here from the standpoint of how many of you, and I know this is sort of way out, how many of you have actually looked at your deed? And the reason I'm asking you this is the way that the system is set up now, when you start talking solar farms, I doubt very seriously if you're going to have a lot of blacks involved because of the way that they're writing up the way they're writing things up here. In other words, you've got, I'm serving as a county commissioner, and I'm looking at some of the things that are being done here. They are actually setting it up so that, for example, you got to have a half a mile of land off the road there before you can put a solar farm in. How many blacks do you know that own a half a mile of land? So long story short, as far as blacks getting involved and really profiting from solar farms, I don't know what's happening in Maryland, but I can tell you that in North Carolina here, it doesn't look good for us. I'm looking at – look at your deed. The way your deeds – a lot of the deeds in North Carolina are written up, especially for blacks, it's more or less. And in most cases, the blacks are going to come up with less. You're not going to be able to put these or to get these solar farms installed. Go on, and it's depending on which media you get your information from. The figures are different as to what lands blacks own in North Carolina and Virginia. If you're asking me how the blacks profit as far as economics from alternate energy, I think we need to take a strong look at getting in on the ground floor here and actually making sure that you're at the table when they start making decisions as to how much land you got to have for a solar farm. How close can you be to another property before you can have a solar farm? You need to be there because once they make these decisions and lock this in, you're going to find that a lot of times the blacks are not going to be a part of the equation.
Well, I can completely concur with what you're saying because I hail from South Carolina. I'm from the PD area. I'm from Dillon, South Carolina, and I've worked on a number of projects and written several business outlines for some landowners in South Carolina as well as North Carolina. And as you eloquently indicated, if you're not at the local planning commission and you're not attending the public service commissions and advocating on the county level with those local politicians as it relates to renewable portfolio standard legislation, and we know that the oil, gas, and fossil fuel industry, they don't walk it, they talk it. In other words, renewable energy, they have no problem with moving to renewables. They just don't want the homeowner to put the PV systems on their roofs, and they just, and as you've elegantly said, with the different requirements for the uplink and the land parcels, because I have already run into those same issues as it relates to those requirements, and without many of our people understanding the relationships with the actual public planning commissions in their counties and how that they are setting these things up. But I also understand that because we all, energy is something that is not a want, it's a need. And as these renewable portfolio standard this legislation is working its way through North Carolina as well as South Carolina state assemblies, and I'm aware of those bills, I've also looked at the need for off-takers for specific projects. I had the opportunity to have the head of the Industrial Hemp Association for the state of North Carolina on the show. I've also had the privilege of having a young man who packages the rural energy assistance program that comes out of the Department of Agriculture, known as the REAP program, talk about some of these same issues in terms of, and I actually asked him, how many African American developers, solar developers or wind developers, or farmers have you actually put together a package, go into the Department of Agriculture to get some of those funding through the REAP program? And he said, the Rural Energy Program, and he said, none. Most of our legislators and on the county as well as state level, they are not even familiar with the Property Assessment Clean Energy Program, known as PACE, and for residential as well as commercial. So we have quite a bit of educating our community around these issues. And yes, I understand that they're talking about moving to renewables, but as you have elegantly said, if we are not at the table when these zoning boards and these planning commissions lay out the terms and conditions, the African American community will be totally locked out. That is one of the reasons why we have formed the National Association of Blacks and Solar. Our vice president is Mr. Will Shirley, the head of Sundial Solar USA. He's based in Jackson, Mississippi. He's the only African American in the solar industry in the entire state. And that is one of the things that he preaches constantly, that we are being locked out of this industry simply because we're not at the table concerning the issues that you have basically said that are going on in North Carolina. They're not just going on in North Carolina and South Carolina. This is a national issue because we know that the bulk of our population, the African-American population, are in the Deep South and Southwest and Mid-Atlantic states. And this is a problem that needs to be addressed from a congressional standpoint by our hearings to talk about these issues. So it's not a shift for me, but I wanted to, because I sort of asked Paul for some questions as to what y'all really wanted to discuss, but I'm glad you sort of opened up Pandora's box about the meat and where we are, because when we begin to look at the EV electric infrastructure bill, this GOP bill, and the monies that's going to be spent for that, those electric charging stations are going to come right through the I-40s.
That's right.
World, the I-95s, the I-85s, and some of those highways are already cut right folks' land. And I've had discussions with landowners who have land with the highways coming through them. But when these opportunities come about, because of the politics on the local level and our people not being aware and informed about these issues, we're completely left out. So with that being said, I agree wholeheartedly. So with that, I want to pose another question. In a perfect world, how would you improve opportunities in renewable energy at for students at UMES and other HBCUs around the country? And either one of you can take that question and elaborate on that. So, Paul, you want to lead off, or Dr. Ellis or Dr. Brown, feel free.
Well, they have a alternate energy program at Elizabeth City State University. That's they actually have a curriculum set up to deal with wind and solar. They have two or three professors there that actually work in this area. So that's being done as we speak.
That's wonderful. That is absolutely wonderful.
UMES, I guess I can speak for us. Well, we're actually in a unique position. Not only just the technology that we have on campus, we've been looking at not just, you know, our 2.2 megawatt solar plant on campus and how we can look at new ways of developing and bringing training programs, because I think that's where the conversation lies. It's more so, okay, how can we bring awareness to the community where farmland is also granted, but the resources needed, and that's whether it's solar or wind. I think that is where UMES has the resource not only to look at data from, we have a 100-meter Met Tower located right on the heart of the campus. That is a unique outfit, because just being in the HBCU here at UMES, on the East Coast is unique, is all right, as well as working with industry. I think that's where we're starting to look at, not just looking at it from an internal approach, but seeing where the needs are, seeing where the local and the federal grant, how that is used to train, develop what technology we can bring forth in the various marketplaces, but in many cases, educating our community how we can invent some of the technology as we go forward. So that's a three-pronged approach, what we are trying to do, not just an internal research environment, but we would like to disseminate that information into an external climate as well. And then the influences of policymakers and the influences of information could be driven based on the data that we are collecting or currently collecting. And we are fortunate to have that ability to do that and a strong community group that we have already formed. So that's from UMES, and definitely Paul can talk more about from the industry side.
And Willie is absolutely right. Dr. Brown, rather, is absolutely right in his assessment of what's going on there. The one thing that we got to add, which is what I believe that UMES was lacking in the past, is we have a president and a chief of staff, Dr. Mock, who are committed to seeing UMES take its place in the vanguard of renewable energy for HBCUs. So they are encouraging relationships between outside developers and staff at UMES. They're just encouraging collaborative ventures at DOE, USDA, and the rest of the schools there to try to, and the rest of the agencies in the government, to see that we can open up avenues and opportunities for our students to learn how to set up platforms, scatter stuff, and develop the workforce for the green energy and industry in the future.
Well, Paul, one of my concerns and one of the things that I have come to realize is that the data speaks for itself. The Solar Industry Trade Association, SEIA, as well as a Solar Foundation that cranks out the numbers, it's clear that we and our HBCUs do an excellent job at training our young people in the engineering fields, and we're graduating our young people, but they're not being hired by, you have over 9,000 solar installation and design companies doing business in the U.S., and we have less than 30 African-American firms. And one of the things that I've come to realize is that, first, the federal government, DOEE, and I guess some of that responsibility will fall back at the level of the HBCUs, don't have sustainability directors or staffing. And when we began to talk about the contact, because I'm working with Dr. Lillian Abrams, which was one of the charter members of National Association of Blacks in Solar. She has the oldest environmental engineering African-American run firm in the U.S. She has 5 offices nationally, 2 offices internationally. Her firm is called Peer Consultants. We developed a 5-year, my company, Positive Change, we developed a 5-year HBCU sustainability plan. And one of the issues that I have seen, and I've seen it time and time again because I'm constantly doing grant research, is that when these grants come out of the Department of Energy, and whether it be on a federal or state level, the turnaround time for getting those documents and putting those proposals together and turning around that information, the window is so short. And most of our African-American solar installation and design companies simply don't have the staffing. So one of the things that we've done at Positive Change is look at how can we get the actual funding to encourage public-private partnerships for our HBCUs to identify those students who may be in the area of business, who may be in the area of engineering, to work at some of our African-American solar installation and design, to write these proposals, to get those grants out so these public-private partnerships can be formed for our HBCUs. And like I said, it's an issue that I know that the federal government has a lot of responsibility falls on its end for lack of investment in our HBCUs in this arena, and there needs to be some specific carve-outs for our HBCUs. And that is one of the things that the National Association of Blacks in Solar is demanding, because this Justice 40 initiative that Biden signed, saying that 40% of this investment in this infrastructure needs to go to communities of color, and to me, that don't cut it. I want to know what's in it for the African-American community and our HBCUs and our black churches, because they control a lot of land, as well as our other, you know, nonprofit organizations is out here advocating for these type of collaborations. And believe me, we are not sleep on this issue. But when we look at an unfunded mandate, because you can issue all the executive orders you want to, but Congress got the power of the purse. So we know what's going on politically as it relates to the challenges on our voting rights and other challenges, but we can walk and chew bubblegum at the same time. And it seems to me, I've recently reached out through the National Association of Blacks in Solar to Jennifer Grant Holmes and asked her to be on a webinar that we tried to schedule way back in July to address some of the concerns that you gentlemen have already identified in your conversation. And it became like, oh, her schedule, I said, well, if the schedule does not allow us to do this webinar in July, what about June? What about July and August? Of course, when I pose that question, you can hear rat urinating on cotton. So we are determined here to get these issues addressed, but we also need to input our HBCUs on what you see as the priorities, whether it would be at Elizabeth City, because when you get to talking about Elizabeth City, it's ironic that American University, GW University, has built a 20-megawatt solar farm near Elizabeth City, North Carolina, and they worked with Pepco and got a specific carve-out through the D.C. government where they could actually uplink that energy and bring it back to Washington, D.C. to offset the energy costs on these campuses. And see, these types of things are not happening for our HBCUs. So if you gentlemen want to weigh in on that, please do.
Well, let's look at supply and demand. Now, I'll give you an example here, and I'm glad you brought that point up. The electric vehicles are coming, whether you like it or not. And there's, as far as demand, there will be a demand for alternate energy or solar panels. There's going to be a demand for that energy. There will be a demand for it. There are a number of things as far as you're talking about training young blacks, whether you approach it from electronic engineering as far as the electric vehicles, the automotive industries, there will be a demand for alternate energy. There will be a demand for solar panels. And as far as training people here, but if they go into automotive engineering, if they go into electronics, if they go, they will be a part of that equation. They will be able to work in the field of solar energy. They will be able to supply energy for all of these electric vehicles that are out there. Now, trust me, if you're driving an electric vehicle, you got to have somewhere to get this energy here. As far as training, you can approach it from that angle. You can approach it from the thing of supply and demand here. We need solar energy for the sake of dealing with the electric vehicles. We need solar energy for the sake of residential. We need solar energy, and it goes on and on. What happens here if your main grid or whatever goes down or whatever, you know, I doubt very seriously if anybody's going to be able to take the sun down. I hope not anyway. So we're going to have some sources.
They're working on it. Yeah, they're working on it. But one of the things that is very concerning to me is that there's so much research and development dollars that are coming through SETU out of the Department the Department of Energy, Science, Energy, and Technology Office. These webinars, they roll these things out every 2 weeks. There's a webinar here, there's a webinar there, and I get these links. I go up on them, and I do a lot of listening. But what's very upsetting to me is the fact that one of our charter members of our organization is WDC Solar, which is headed by Mr. Mark Davis, who's one of the charter members of the National Association of Blacks in Solar. He's put together a virtual workforce development training program, and we're in the process of right now working with of opening up lines of communication with a number of our HBCUs in order to provide this training virtually, but we still have to work with the Paul Reeves of this world, because Paul's firm and other firms that have boots on the ground can actually give our young students the hands-on training. One of the things that's very, very unique about UMS, and as you've spoken about the program in Elizabeth City, I'm working right now with Mrs. Felicia Davis, who's a head of the HBCU Green Fund out of Atlanta, Georgia, and she's advocating right now and working, trying to get more funding just to deal with a number of the issues around what we're talking about in terms of the electric vehicle infrastructure. Qcell, which is the largest manufacturer of solar panels, which is based in Dalton, Georgia, I just sent a Senator Ossoff's office about opening negotiations so that our companies would be able to bulk buy panels for projects that they have on their books, and also to talk to them about opening up their discussions about apprenticeship programs for some of our HBCUs. So I think that there's a number of things that we can seize upon, because whether we like it or not, the Senate has already passed by 2025, all 50 states in the United States must have some form of renewable portfolio standard legislation to combat climate change. And as this happens, we see this cost of how it's going to be paid for on our gas, water, and electric bills in the form of pass-throughs. So, black folks, we're going to pay for this green infrastructure revolution, whether we know it or not. I don't care whether you got a house, apartment, or shoebox, but how do we make sure that not just to, as Mr. Mark Davis elegantly said, he said, I'm not in the business of just getting people certified and not have jobs to place them in. We need to have these projects developed with our HBCUs and our black farmers and our black churches that have land, as well as the infrastructure piece in terms of putting PV systems on the roofs of our churches, because we know that that can create the job opportunities that President Barack Hussein Obama put into place. And one thing for sure, had it not been for Van Jones, who offered the Green Job Act after Katrina hit New Orleans, because solar ain't new. It's been around since the early 60s, since the space program. But it didn't take off until Congress codified the Green Jobs Act. But $500 million went to all, each state got $10 million from workforce development training. And I just spoke with Mr. Will Shirley. They're trying to start a workforce development training program for Tougaloo. And the state of Mississippi got the money, but it's not just Mississippi. All of our states have this money, but they have not invested one dime in a workforce development training program to be implemented at our HBCUs and community colleges. So these issues have to be brought to the forefront, and they have to be put out. And if they're dirty laundry, then we got to agitate, because you can't clean filthy underwear unless you got some agitation in the wash. So if any of you gentlemen white could weigh in on that, I would greatly appreciate it.
Well, let me just go back with this and definitely hear what you said. I think one thing that the HBCU has a unique ability to do as we look at a digital age, I think that's where we are. Dealing with innovation and looking at the current job structure, is it suited for our current HBCUs? That's something that each HBCU has to assess. But just being able to talk from the various experiences teaching and working at HBCUs, just like we were in a time where education and we were trying to figure out how to educate our own communities, I think this is where the conversation is now with HBCUs, with the ability and what we have, the uniqueness of programs. And I think we mentioned this earlier about this uniqueness of programs and the interdisciplinaries of programs that we currently have. One thing that you will find out, even in the two schools that we are talking about in conversation, Elizabeth City and University of Maryland Eastern Shore, we have some specialized knit programs with emphasis on renewable energy, the industry in itself, and opportunities for job placement, where innovation it has not yet not only have been developed or come to what we consider a stage of deployment. So what we are trying to do currently at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore in the Department of Engineering and Aviation Sciences is, at this point, gather data. We're trying to see, okay, what is the data? We have this solar farm. What were some of the things that we learned from this, but some things that we can improve on? How can we build more partnership? But we realize that it cannot necessarily be an internal thing. It has to be a community, academia, and we also have to look at an industry. So we have to look at those three pillars as we go forward. So with industry in itself, that's the opportunity. With academia, we are the researchers. We are the individuals who give you the assessment, the learn less, and our communities, dealing with the businesses of communities and dealing with our community. That's that part of development and the training. That would be our recruitment group going forward. So with the uniqueness of aviation and agricultural or cybersecurity, technology, engineering, we're now not only where we start to look at the PWIs, schools versus the HBCUs, they do not necessarily have the same, what we should say, the course offerings or academic composition as the HBCU. So we are in a unique position. Now, the problem would be going forward, how would that model work, and how would we be able to tap the right individuals and the commitment from both the private and the public sector, as well as academia. So that is where we're definitely seeing the biggest challenge. And then proving to ourselves and proving that model to the federal government. Like you said, we have to account for the money. We have to account for our research. And I think that's where all three of us on the phone with Elizabeth City, Paul Reeves and his company, and as well as myself, We are now in those discussions. How can we make sure that we can be viable to the research community? How can we be viable to the industry? And how can we advance more so the industry and make a new pathway for what we are trying to do?
Well, I'm looking at where we are right now, we all know that the GOP infrastructure bill, that's what I call it, the one that allegedly was passed, in looking at the, you'll find that on my website at positivechangepc.com. And I'm just going to give you an example of what I'm indicating is taking place right from a recent article that I just posted that had the fact sheet from the actual White House from what is in and what was promised. Now, as we look at the what is actually in this bill, this was Senate votes to move forward bipartisan infrastructure bill, and this was published on the 7th, 29th of June of course, CBS News, Washington, D.C., and they talked about the fact that, according to the White House fact sheet, the legislation will include $40 billion for bridges, repair, replacement, and rehabs, $66 billion for investment in Amtrak passenger rail, $39 billion for modernization of public and transit and improving access to elderly people, $55 billion for clean water investment, $65 billion for broadband internet deployment, $7.5 billion for EV charging infrastructure nationally. Now, at the bottom of that, I have an article which I wrote with Mr. Will Shirley, where is the Green Economic Development Plan for African Americans and the implementation of the Biden Infrastructure Plan? Now, the reason why I put that link there, when you go to that particular article and you slide down, you will see the actual request that we put in the webinar for Jennifer Grant Holmes. But inside of that article, you'll find an article that was written by the New York Times that talks about what actually was proposed and in the infrastructure bill. And when we look at HBCUs, for what's in that reconciliation bill is for HBCUs, $25 billion was supposed to be coming forth in this next reconciliation bill. Community investment, $20 billion. Innovation and competitiveness, $14 billion. Underserved communities, $12 billion. Renewable rural partnership programs, $5 billion. Small business support, $31 billion. We're talking about supply chain support, $50 billion. Workforce development, $48 billion. This is what the GOP did not want to vote for. We know that this is where the rubber meets the road, the things that I just read off, which will give more access to for our HBCUs. Now, Van Jones just received a $100 million gift from Microsoft, from Jeff Bars, for the Green for All program. So it would be, and I'm reaching out because we're trying to syndicate this particular show through one of our black-owned urban radio networks so it can be syndicated and heard around the country and not just be in the form of a podcast, and we'll be able to give this show weekly to our radio stations that we ran, because most of our HBCU stations are NPR stations. That means they broke and they got to continually ask for money with fundraisers. This is one of our major impediments, is to get this information that you gentlemen are sharing with our community today out to our community, because if our people are unaware, and if they don't know, then you suffer from the lack of knowledge, and that's just a fact. Because you can have it, but I've got to have a plan of action to go with that. So, with that being said, these are things that our communities need to be aware of. These are the things that they need, the reason why they need to be calling their senators and raising holy hell about, because our communities, our HBCUs, cannot survive if we don't get more support from that kind of advocacy aspect from their alumni and from students around these issues. These issues are, like I said, we can do more than one thing, because voting, I agree, politics determine who gets what. So that if it's number one, the things we're talking about got to be number two, because if the economics, and as we all know, Congress has the power of the purse, and they will determine who gets what, and we have to be at the table. Gentlemen, with that being said, I scheduled y'all for in half an hour. We've already done 55 minutes, and we're going to be going off the air in about 5 minutes. So with with everything being said, what would you like to leave our listening audience today, Dr. Ellis, Dr. Brown, and then you, Paul?
Well, I guess if I have anything as far as leaving information, I ask that you please get involved from the local level and make sure that you know what's going on in your communities and at your HBCUs. Make sure you know what's out there as far as grants, what's available to you. And if you can't find the information or whatever, then you've got people such as the ones that were on this panel that you can call or get in touch with, and we all get together and move this horse forward.
Thank you for that. And that's words of wisdom and wise. So, Dr. Brown?
Not only what we are having this discussion is so important, but a level of awareness. I really believe that a lot of times in our community, we do not have a level of awareness. With that said, because we are not only trying to bring innovation here in the various industry, which is renewable, once we're aware of the situation or the challenges of the issue, now we also have to have a level of commitment to see it through. And with those two action items, advocates such as yourself, Ronald, and individuals in the communities where platforms are used to advocate for the HBCUs, we definitely appreciate it. And you do have a LIFT community. Don't think that you do not necessarily have that impact. But those items in itself, we need individuals to continue to advocate for HBCUs. We're here. We're still educating some of the best engineers, and we're still educating the most Black engineers of all institutions within the HBCU community. So we have a lot of success. And a lot of times it's not discussed as much as the challenges, but it is success in the HBCU community. And thank you for advocating for that.
Well, thank you very much. Paul?
Well, I was wondering what I could say here. It is just really great to have Dr. Brown and Dr. Lawrence on the line and telling about their views of what's occurring on HBCU campuses. And I want to thank you, Ronald, for bringing us all together here and having a chance to have a forum where we can talk about things. And hopefully this will spark other discussions at other HBCUs where we can start having to develop a common vision of the future, where we will actually be, as I enjoyed Dr. Lawrence's analogy, you know, we need to be sitting at the table, so that we can split up the pie. I think that we need to be sitting at the table to discuss policy, or we become the menu. And that's what I have to say today.
Well, gentlemen, you won't be a stranger to this platform, Solar Now in the Future, with its economic impact on Black America. And I want to thank all three of you, gentlemen, for taking time from your very, very busy schedules to be guests on this platform, Solar Now in the Future, with its economic impact on Black America. Now, for our listening audience, you normally I break and have do several commercials, but this, everybody knows this show is brought to you every week by the Positive Change Purchasing Cooperative, LLC, which serves as a blueprint for economic self-reliance for solar and renewable energy companies, both large and small, along with increasing market share for African-American solar installation companies, to address the effects of high energy costs at our historically Black colleges and universities, which is the number two fixed cost at any university, whether they be Black, white, green or polka dot. So the cost of energy is a fixed cost, period. So until next week, we were saying we don't want you to meet us here. We want you to beat us back here. Until next week, we say go in peace. Gentlemen, thank you once again for being guests on Soul and Now and the Future.
Thank you.
With the Economic Impact on Black America as we close another exciting edition of Soul and Now and the Future with its Economic Impact on Black America. Until next week, we say go in peace. Y'all have a blessed day.
Someone singing, I can just sing it. Life is a song worth singing, I can just sing it. You hold a key in the palm of your hand, use it. Don't blame your life on a master plan. Power to decide what to do.